Thank you so much, Pierre, for taking the time and coming on the show today. I've been looking forward to this conversation. You are one of the most prolific voices in Bitcoin. You've been hanging around the space for several years now, which is a lot longer than, a lot of the other voices that are talking about Bitcoin these days. I know when you joined, you looked at maybe some of the 2011 guys as the OGs, but from my perspective, you're one of the OGs as well. So it's great to have you on. Looking forward to talking about Bitcoin and your story and things like that.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for having me on, Jake.
Yeah, so why don't we get started actually by going back to when you kind of first got introduced to Bitcoin back in, I think it was 2013, right? And just hearing how kind of your origin story unfolded.
Yeah, that's right. Although I think that it makes more sense for people if we go back even further of when did I get interested in the topic of money or monetary economics? And that was back in 2005. I was in high school and started learning about anarcho-capitalism first on the politics side because I stumbled onto a Wikipedia page. And then from there, Austrian economics, Ludwig von Mises, and Murray Rothbard and 100% reserve banking and gold as money. And that's where I really formed my views on what is good money, what's bad money, what are the consequences of bad money. And that was way before even Satoshi had started working on Bitcoin, which we estimate to be about 2007. And it was before the financial crisis, but every so, I was into like stacking silver back then, and I think that it helps folks to know that because they think that I'm obsessed with Bitcoin, when really it's not so much that I'm obsessed with Bitcoin. I'm obsessed with sound money, and when I heard about Bitcoin the first time around, I didn't realize it was sound money. I didn't even look into its monetary policy. I just thought it was internet money that, like WoW gold, except decentralized. That is, that anyone could create it, and there wasn't really any serious scarcity to it. It wasn't until I heard about Bitcoin the second time that I actually heard that there were only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. And I had theorized that a money that had a fixed ceiling in terms of quantity would actually be better than gold, because of gold's, at least 2% increase in supply every year. So it immediately struck a chord with me, and it became clear to me that it was going to increase in value because there wasn't really a way to have a better monetary policy than just having a fixed supply. And that's what threw me down the rabbit hole. And at the end of 2012, beginning of 2013. And so I started writing a few things and started tweeting. Although those tweets are gone now because I deleted my Twitter account, I think like in 2016 or something like that, and came back in 2017. But in any case, when I did first start reading, it was very Reddit focused back then. The Bitcoin subreddit was really, I think, where the conversation was going on. And it was also in person because at my University of Texas at Austin, that's where I heard about Bitcoin the second time. And I heard about it in the context of a Austrian economics reading group called the Mises Circle. And there were, some legends there, like Michael Goldstein, who were studying Austrian economics and who were going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole at the time as well.
That's a great introduction, and it does make sense to start earlier, like I think, like you did, talking about how you got into good money versus bad money in the first place. A couple questions for you on that point. If you could kind of briefly introduce what, from your perspective, differentiates good money from bad money, I think that would be helpful for people. I like to, I like to keep this entertaining and informative for people who are like really into Bitcoin or really into crypto, but also sometimes ask some really fundamental questions that might be interesting to someone who's not yet so familiar. So that would be helpful. And then secondarily, maybe, and maybe this is a part of that, I know you studied like Keynesian economics, but then, you know, we're more so excited by Austrian economics and maybe a couple of other types of monetary theory. If you could kind of compare and contrast those from like a very high level, that would be helpful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the first question of good money versus bad money, there's different schools of thought on it. And I think that all of them have some truth to their perspective, and they don't all capture the same parts of it. So one way to look at it is just as kind of a consequentialist perspective of, well, what money has positive effects on the economy, right? However you want to define that. So it's a very like utilitarian argument. And I think that that's not a great way to look at it, because it's very hard to tease out exactly cause and effects, especially if you're trying to look at aggregates of demand and supply and a whole complex economy. So I'm very skeptical of that point of view. Now, another one is kind of the expectations point of view of a good money is a money that sets expectations and then meets those expectations. And I think Bitcoin actually excels in that regard, where the rules of the system are very well defined and expectations are set very well. And not only are expectations set by the system, but because it's decentralized, the users themselves are part of the process of setting expectations. And it's not like it's even more user driven than gold, for example, because with gold you can have exogenous shocks. For example, the discovery of the new world. Oh, okay, but we found a bunch of new gold and it just floods the market. Or, you know, in the future, they're going to bring in a gold asteroid and mine it. So the fiat system, they actually have, by design and by intent, maximum expectation uncertainty. And I say that because otherwise monetary policy wouldn't work. If people knew that you were going to change monetary policy, then they would price it in. And then when you change monetary policy, nothing would happen. And so there's these weird feedback loops where in the fiat system, they have to have shock and awe and surprise the markets in order to be able to move the markets and to direct them where they want to go or manipulate them less charitably. So there's the expectations lens. And this is really important, especially with regards to the price level. So for example, people will say, oh, the problem with deflation is that if you have a loan, then your loan value is going to go up and you'll never be able to get out of debt because you can never pay off your loan due to deflation. And that's only true if you had a different expectation going into the loan. If you went into a loan expecting to never be able to pay it off, like nobody would do that. So clearly the problem with deflation is when it's unexpected deflation. And there's also a similar effect in inflation where people start expecting inflation and it causes it to accelerate. Okay, so back to good money versus bad money. I think that another way to look at it is what wins in the free market. So this is kind of the Austrian view of, well, whatever ends up getting used as money is sound money. And so whatever's driven by free market process is sound money. So I agree with that. The problem is that we don't have a free market, and the government actually intervenes in the market quite a lot. And so it warps our ability to even define what is sound money or not, because now it's not that the US dollar is sound money, it's that we don't know, because we don't know the alternative universe where the US dollar is not being subsidized by the government. And it's also the case that, and this is a point that Nick Szabo makes, is that what's the point of economic analysis, like saying, oh, sound money is whatever the free market decides, if there's no universe where we have that free market? So we have to accept as a premise that the government is going to intervene, and then we have to base our monetary economics on that. So the last piece I would put as sound money, which is my strongly held view, it has to do with the monetary policy first and foremost, and the credibility of that monetary policy. So by the monetary policy, I mean what kind of supplier is the monetary authority saying that's going to come onto the market? And so with Bitcoin, obviously that's very well defined, and the monetary authority is decentralized. And so the credibility of that, to me, is pretty maximal. And there's not really any way to have more credibility or have a better monetary policy. And so that's what makes Bitcoin the best money or the soundest money, and that it always will be that way. And I don't think that there's within the world of monetary economics that there's a lot of economists who hold that view, that it's purely about the supply. Although I think that if you look at the history of monetary economics, it all points in this direction. And I think Saifedean and others are kind of bringing monetary economics to a post-Bitcoin equilibrium, where we can finally agree that it has to do with supply much more so than anything else. Now, it does raise the question of why is it that the US dollar was able to have an advantage over gold? And, you know, we could say, well, it's because of government intervention. But I also think that there's an element to the credibility of the monetary policy that is not a macroeconomic element, but actually a microeconomic element of, does the specific unit of money that I am receiving, is its specific monetary policy credible? In other words, is this a real unit? Is this authentic? And with gold, you have to melt it down, you have to assay it, and even if it's real gold, it might be faded a little bit, it might be clipped a little bit. And then with bank bills, kind of under the free banking system, you know, you had bills circulating at a discount. Are they counterfeit? Are they not counterfeit? And really what allowed the dollar to outcompete gold is a technology where you made it very expensive to counterfeit $100 bills. And so it was really advancements in paper technology and anti-counterfeiting and serial numbers, and then, of course, computing and cryptography that allowed the dollar to be verifiable at a microeconomic level, such that even if it didn't have as good of a monetary policy at a macro level as gold, it still had a better monetary policy than gold at a micro level of your ability to independently verify that you're holding a real dollar bill and the cost of doing so. So now with Bitcoin, I think that that cost gets driven even lower. Not only is it inexpensive to run a Bitcoin node, but it's also what you get from it, the assurances you get from it are orders of magnitude better than, for example, being able to verify that a $100 bill is real or that a bar of gold is real. The confidence you have in your conclusion is far greater because of the cryptography. And not only do you have this level of almost absolute certainty at the microeconomic level, running a Bitcoin node and verifying your own transaction, you also have that same confidence at a macro level of, well, now you're able to verify the global supply of Bitcoin, which was something that you weren't even able to do with gold, and you certainly weren't able to do with fiat. And so now I would say that the what separates good money from bad money is, can you independently verify the money that you are receiving and the total money supply of it, of the unit? And nothing surpasses Bitcoin on both of those.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I like how you come at the question from several different perspectives, and then what it seemed to boil down to in the end, from at least my understanding, is there's kind of like two primary factors, one macro, one micro. The macro being, can you have some degree of certainty in the supply for the foreseeable future? And so with the dollar, the answer is no. For gold, the answer is better, but still not totally if we start mining asteroids and things like that. And with the Bitcoin, the answer is yes, there's only going to be 21 million. So Bitcoin kind of wins there. And then on the micro level, your theory as to why the dollar sort of overtook gold was that it's easier to have certainty. Again, it comes down to kind of like certainty or predictability in the macro case, but you can kind of know in the case of the dollar that a $100 bill is legitimate, versus gold is a little bit more complex to verify to, you know, a strong degree of certainty. And Bitcoin, like you said, you know, wins on that level as well, where it's undeniably verifiable. So is that a fair kind of short synthesis of where you kind of land with that?
Yeah, that's right. And then you had another question about Keynesian economics versus Austrian economics. And there, I think that it's part of it is kind of well, there's two parts to that debate. I think that one is the political debate of what it's about, you know, libertarianism versus statism, and should the government be intervening at all? The other question, though, is one of methodology, which is how should economists analyze the world, or how should economic theory be developed? And the Keynesians and neoclassical economists tend to go towards, well, you know, we got to run experiments and we got to use the scientific method and empiricism. Whereas the Austrians favor that this is, as a social science, it's not really appropriate to use empiricism because we're talking about things that could be looked at logically. And, you know, in the same way that math is looked at logically rather than empirically, and that we can derive conclusions from that. So, you know, that's still an ongoing debate. What I found interesting when I first started learning about this is that in the school system, they don't see it as a debate. In fact, they don't even, they're not even aware that there's different points of views on this. So they don't really, not only do they not teach it, or argue about it. But if you ask an economics professor about, you know, hey, could you describe Austrian economics to me? Most of them will give you a blank stare. They even at a PhD level, they don't really learn about it. And so I had to learn about it on the internet. And I know that might sound like, well, you're going to come up with some pretty outlandish crank theories if you just do your research on the internet. But there's kind of a sociological argument for why they would not teach it. They would not teach you about it in school. And that is that the education system is geared towards amplifying government propaganda, not really about discovering truths about the world. So for the Austrians, I think that the main thing that to me matters for this argument of empiricism versus what they call a priori logic is, are humans so individually unique that we can't generalize about them? And that I think it's actually a weirdly like modern thing to think that humans could do anything, and thus we can't have any principles about what humans can or can't do, compared to, like, if you actually study history and you start seeing the patterns, you're like, okay, well, humans kind of have a fairly set range of behaviors, and there's not really anything new happening today. We just think there is out of ignorance, not because humans are rapidly evolving or changing.
Yeah. Do you think that there's any, like, is it reasonable at all to think that humans may fundamentally be changing in terms of how we could interact with something as fundamental as money due to sort of a shift, like a major shift in the history of humankind that one could argue is underway as a result of sort of digital technology and maybe this information or knowledge age, as opposed to kind of the industrial age, which followed the agrarian age?
Well, I guess the principles, though, remain the same. And it's the same thing with the agrarian age versus the industrial age. You know, if you look at, okay, well, what's the efficiency of someone manually, digging dirt to plow a field, or using a horse to plow a field, versus the efficiency of them using a tractor to plow a field, they're still plowing a field. You know, it's really the fundamentals haven't really changed. And that's where, you know, I think that with Bitcoin, okay, well, what happens when people have a better money? Well, to me, they hold more of it, and the general price level relative to money holding goes down. And, you know, we call that deflation. And that's, so, you know, I think that it'll modify behaviors, but the fundamental principles of it will remain the same. And so I feel like that's what has allowed, you know, what I wrote in 2013 and 2014 to have withstood the test of time, is because when I wrote it out of respect for the general principle, rather than trying to fit some kind of new theory or create a new theory to accommodate Bitcoin, rather than applying the existing monetary economics that I was familiar with from the Austrian school to Bitcoin. And so, you know, it'll seem new to us, but I think that, you know, people saving money is pretty timeless.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I was just curious to hear your perspective there. I think some things are changing, but certainly some principles will stand the test of time, at least for the foreseeable future. I want to talk about an interesting decision that you made, and maybe it wasn't like a one moment or one day thing, but you talked about on another podcast, and I just want to hear you kind of elaborate on it. You just loosely referenced it, and that is, you know, and you referenced it again here that in school, you know, that they just teach Keynesian economics, even PhDs couldn't really tell you much about Austrian economics for the most part. But you kind of stumbled upon this Wikipedia page, like you mentioned, and then sort of started going down and learning more about Austrian economics. And you mentioned in this other podcast how it sort of occurred to you at that point that maybe taking for granted that everything you learn in school is true is sort of a false assumption. And you had this sort of decision to make whether you wanted to kind of shut it down on these extracurricular kind of searches for knowledge and learning through the internet, and sort of have what probably seemed like it would be an easier existence thereafter, or if you wanted to kind of continue to learn more outside of what the system was telling you and have to kind of navigate that. You know, the more you learn, the more you have to navigate the differences between the two. And so it was maybe sort of a bit of a tough decision. I'm just curious to hear sort of how you navigated that and maybe how you reflect upon that choice now.
Yeah, I guess the decision was more subconscious than conscious. I think that while I struggled with it and I thought about it, it's not like I laid out the pros and cons at the time, but rather I just kept going in that direction. I couldn't help myself. So maybe it's more of a, just my nature. And the other thing that made it easier was that at that time I'd had schooling in France and I'd had schooling in the United States and saw the kind of self-serving arguments that were, you know, kind of nationalistic about both parties. And the other, so that made it easier to kind of just question the schooling in general. But the other part is that the postmodern like critical theory part of French schooling of, well, you know, everything's a social construct, that's kind of self-defeating because it becomes self-referential, and so it makes it easier for me to, or it made it easier for me, I think, to question what the school was teaching me when they were actually teaching me to question what the school was teaching me. But they were probably hoping that it would go into a different direction than it did.
Right. So, so one thing that I don't know if I've mentioned explicitly so far, for those who don't know, you co-founded the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, or maybe it's just called the Nakamoto Institute. Right. So that's basically like, I was, you know, surfing through the website and you've got a bunch of correspondences of his and quotes and things alike, and also some really good reading recommendations that I actually want to dig deeper into myself and read some more things from kind of older monetary theory type people. But I think, you know, there may be no people who are more kind of familiar and researched on Satoshi than you. So I'm curious to hear, first of all, just like sort of an appreciation for Satoshi and how you think about him, and then maybe more specifically, aspects of his sort of legend that, and who he was that you think, or is, or, you know, the group or whatever it might be that you think are sort of underappreciated by, not just like, you know, overall like the world, but actually people who do believe strongly in Bitcoin and like appreciate Satoshi, but they're still underestimating maybe this one or two components of what he did and who he was.
Yeah. So first I would say that, you know, to me, the founder of the Nakamoto Institute is Michael Goldstein. And he took me and others along for the ride. And he's the one who put together the Satoshi archive itself. And so he is far more familiar with Satoshi's writings than I am. In terms of how I think about Satoshi, I think that it's best for folks to not think about Satoshi in general. And that it's really, it's about the decentralized system itself. And that is much bigger, than Satoshi. Now, I don't want to, you know, minimize Satoshi's role, obviously, and how important, it is that he created Bitcoin. But in terms of, for example, Bitcoin's governance, I think it has been a problem of people using arguments from authority of, well, Satoshi said this or Satoshi said that, because it goes back to what I was talking about with regards to expectations earlier. If people take what Satoshi wrote as setting expectations for what Bitcoin is, they're in for a huge disappointment, because empirically, that's not what sets the expectations in Bitcoin. It's the code itself, what is written in the software that you are running, that is the actual expectations. And what Satoshi said, you know, is tangential to that. And it's more about Satoshi's. So, you know, if we say that the code is law, then what Satoshi wrote might be old commentaries on old laws, laws that might not even exist anymore. And it's, you know, we could read those commentaries and have thoughts about their applicability today and how much forethought they had, or how he didn't see some things coming. But to me, there's two things that we don't value enough about Satoshi. One is that Satoshi wrote the software, wrote the code before he wrote the Bitcoin white paper. And so to me, the Bitcoin white paper is overrated and the code itself is underrated, both from kind of what happened first, but also what matters today. And that it often gets overlooked that the white paper was written for a particular audience. It wasn't meant to be a manifesto for the general public. And so I don't think that someone reading the white paper today would come away thinking that that Bitcoin is important, right? In fact, they might come away thinking, well, it's a good idea, not even that it's something that exists today. So there's that. And then the second one is on what happened after Satoshi released the code and the software, which is that Satoshi mined a bunch of Bitcoin. And approximately, I think people estimate it's like 1 million Bitcoin that he mined, which is actually, now it's not even that big of a percentage of the total supply. So he could sell all of those Bitcoin if he still has access to them. And I don't think that the price would go to zero. It would maybe, now that we're at like, I don't know, 55K, this is going to date the podcast. you know, maybe it would go down to 10K or something, or to 5K. But he mined those Bitcoin when the price was $0. And the price of electricity at the time was greater than $0. And so he mined those Bitcoin at a loss. And I think that goes underappreciated, both in the sense of, you know, he was not someone who was trying to maximize profit, because then he would not have mined at all, right? And he was someone who really believed in Bitcoin's future. And so I think that, he probably thought that the coins would accrue value. But then it brings up the follow-up question of how much value does he think that they are going to accrue before he sells them? And does he still have access to the private keys? And why has he not already sold? And so I think that those three points, that he wrote the code before the white paper, he mined at a loss, and he still hasn't sold. To me, those are pretty astounding things about Satoshi that I haven't heard of any other cryptocurrency project following in the least. So he also, he wrote the software, as far as I know, he wrote the Bitcoin software without any VC funding. You know, he didn't have a token offering. People say like, oh, there needs to be funding for developers. It's like, well, where did Satoshi get his funding, right? Because clearly that was enough. That was enough funding for him to do what he did. The other interesting thing about open source is when people say, these software engineers are selfless heroes. It's like, well, open source software developers write code to scratch their own itch. You know, they're not like Mother Teresa. You know, they're doing it for themselves. They're not even necessarily doing it for others at all. But anyway, yeah,
that's a super interesting response. Much more than I could have possibly expected. I'm really glad I asked, because it's interesting. I mean, you have this. You're, even if you consider Michael Goldstein to be like the founder, you're at least called a co-founder and have had somewhat of a significant role in the whole thing. And you started off the answer by saying basically like people should stop thinking so much about Satoshi. And then proceeded to talk about like the white paper being overvalued relative to the code is not something I've explicitly heard before. It's like you start to think about it as the white paper trying to describe the code for a very specific audience versus the white paper being sort of like the Bible, which is a very different perspective to take, which I think is super interesting. And then the whole part about him, mining at a loss and still holding is also quite intriguing. Let's talk about Bitcoin more directly for the last, couple or 15 minutes or whatever that we have. I've heard that you come to believe that Bitcoin will be sort of the global reserve currency. And correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but you believe that there will only be one major cryptocurrency, that it'll be sort of like a Pareto thing where it'll be 80%+ of the overall value of the global system. And you clarified, I heard previously, that, you know, that's not like something that you wish to happen, but that's something that you believe will happen. Can you talk a bit more about why you think that it will boil down to ultimately one main currency, and why that currency will be Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it goes to what the purpose of a money is, which is something that you can hold that has liquidity. To me, the main argument for why historically we've ended up with having one global money, it was gold until the 20th century, and now it's US dollars. And the reason that is because of the network effects of liquidity. So the more liquid a currency or a money is, the more liquidity it attracts, and it kind of snowballs from there. Why it will be Bitcoin? Well, that goes to the first question about good money versus bad money. And here it's really, I think that it's confusing for folks, because we experience money in reverse order. And by that I mean that in a fiat system specifically, we experience money as a payment system, not as a store of value. And so we think of it, you know, as like living paycheck to paycheck, and that thus we thought that adoption would happen in that way of, well, merchants will accept Bitcoin and then magically we'll be spending Bitcoin all the time. What happens in a scenario of a strong money replacing a weak money is hoarding. And so we see not merchants accepting Bitcoin as being the adoption driver, but rather merchants like MicroStrategy going out and buying a bunch of Bitcoin and borrowing money to buy Bitcoin, borrowing fiat to buy Bitcoin. And so the adoption driver isn't the transaction costs or the point of sale user experience being better for Bitcoin than for fiat. Rather, what the adoption driver is that you can borrow at a low interest rate, you can borrow fiat, and then you can buy Bitcoin, and that it's a carry trade. And the reason you can do that is because Bitcoin has a better monetary policy than the dollar. And the only way for the dollar to stop that from happening is by the dollar improving its monetary policy. And that's just not possible. And we can get into that. But the reason I think that Bitcoin will end up dominating as kind of the global reserve currency is because it has the best monetary policy, and that all of the other competitors, and I said Pareto like 80-20. I don't know anymore how true that is. I'm starting to become more maximalist. It might end up being 98 too. The only reason I would stick to 80-20 is if we end up having governments have their money be backed by Bitcoin. So that would be the 20% would be governments with monies that are backed by Bitcoin. And they might do that. They would probably, I would guess that it will be authoritarian governments that do that because they want to have maximum surveillance over the currency. But even in that case, I don't know. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical because I really think that the desire to inflate and to even if, and this happened with gold, right? Like they had a gold-backed currency and they wanted inflation so much that what did they end up doing? They ended up breaking the exchange rate, the fixed exchange rate they had to gold. And so I think that governments will do that with Bitcoin too, if they end up trying to have a Bitcoin-backed currency. So all this to say that if fiat currencies can't have a better monetary policy than Bitcoin and all the other cryptos can't either, then it just seems like a no-brainer to me that Bitcoin will continue to ascend to having the global reserve currency status.
Right. So when you first discovered Bitcoin and or rather the second time you discovered it, when you realized that this was good money from your perspective, it had a much smaller valuation than it does now. Obviously, I'm not sure where it was exactly, but maybe in the hundreds. Where was it?
It was $20 or something like that.
Yeah, $20, even better. So it was, the market cap was not indicative of like what it could be. Obviously at that point it could be argued that it's nowhere near there still today at $1 trillion. But when did you identified, you said like conceptually and like functionally via the code, like this is good money. But at that point I would assume that you saw vulnerabilities to it actually playing out, whether it could kind of gain enough steam, whether it had certain vulnerabilities. Can you kind of share where you are today versus where you were then in terms of sort of your thinking on the inevitability of Bitcoin specifically, not just the idea of Bitcoin becoming like the new global, you know, form of money, but actually like Bitcoin being the one that succeeds. And maybe you did think from the beginning that you know, you saw it and you were like, this is it for sure. But I'm curious if like from a probability perspective at that point, you were like, oh, kind of maybe 30% chance this sort of achieves its destiny that I could see it achieving. And maybe now today you're at like 98 or wherever you might be.
Yeah, I guess when the flip switched, sorry, when the switch flipped, when I was going down the rabbit hole, it really went from zero to 100, because two things. One is that it was at, I think it was like $200 million market cap. And I figured that, you know, a good hacker, right, a good software engineer who would want to make money, that hundreds of millions of dollars would be more than enough to pay for their troubles. So it kind of seemed like the honeypot was big enough, and that if nobody was breaking it, then it was good to go. And that if it was good to go, that the monetary economics were good, that it was just kind of a straight path to world domination. So I think that I was probably irrationally confident at the time, you know, although hindsight 2020, you know, I was exactly right. But I had a tremendous amount of confidence in it. The moment that I saw how much value was riding on it already, and that, you know, at that point it had been working for 4 years or so or whatever. And I was young. I guess I still am young, but I think when you're in your early 20s, you're not wise enough to be skeptical of things like this. And so maybe there was some youthful ignorance involved there too.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I sympathize with the view that you took on like the honeypot being big enough, that if it's like, I'm not a technical person, so for me, I have to kind of approach it from like a social diligence perspective, seeing what other people say. And, you know, I can read things for myself, of course, but there's a large component of social diligence. And then just like practically speaking, like I see, you know, someone early, like last year, I guess, hacked Twitter. And what did they do with that incredible power to be able to like tweet from like Trump's account or Putin's account or whatever? They just went on a bunch of celebrities' accounts and asked for Bitcoin. And to me, that's like, well, if they need to hack Twitter to get a hold of Bitcoin, and maybe it's not like a perfect example, but you've seen other examples as well where people are making like pretty seemingly tough to do hacks. And in that case, it ended up being like someone internal, so maybe not like the hardest thing in the world, but they get in a position of large power due to a hack, and then all they want is Bitcoin. It tells me that, and I mean, plus today it's at $1 trillion, so that's proof in and of itself. But that specific idea that it's like hackable, for me, I've also sort of ruled out by similar logic, I think, granted, you know, a few years later. I think the last thing I have to ask you is, you know, you have already taken a pretty drastic like evolution maybe in what you might have, and I don't know, but like what you might have imagined in like high school or even college. Like I know you were studying accounting. I think you got your master's in accounting as well. And then Bitcoin obviously shifted things a bit for you, and you started heading down a very different path than one that you might have imagined. Like you said, you're still relatively young. I'm curious what you, in your mind, like what's in store for your future, Bitcoin or otherwise. I know it's, you know, a large component of what you do, obviously, but I'm curious kind of what you have in store, especially given like being involved with Bitcoin early. I think a lot of people who are kind of early in the crypto space have some opportunities to do some pretty interesting things with, you know, the monetary benefit maybe from being involved early. So I'm just kind of curious what you have in store.
Yeah. My first priority is keeping my head screwed on straight, because I've seen others, kind of skid out of control, and some OGs, you know, kind of lose it. In Matt O'Dell's words, staying humble and stacking sats, priority number one. And then obviously, being a good dad, another focus of mine. Professionally, you know, I'm at Kraken, and I enjoy it here a lot, and we'll have more news coming out this year, more announcements this year about different things at Kraken that I'm working on. But I don't necessarily need to be working at Kraken anymore or anywhere, but I like it a lot, and I like I like that I don't really know, honestly. I don't really have a good answer for you, because something new is always happening in the world of Bitcoin. And even when I look at what kind of products and use cases are going to be unlocked by upgrades like Taproot, and improvements to the Lightning Network, it's mind-boggling to me. Now, on the kind of what to do in terms of humanity, right? Like, I think that there's folks who are very focused on space. I find space interesting as well. But like when I watched Interstellar, I kind of got anxious. I get too much anxiety about going to space. So I don't think that I'm like Elon Musk, you know, go to Mars. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'll just end up gardening, honestly, because the idea of going on a rocket is not super appealing to me. In fact, even now that I don't have to go on airplanes because of COVID, you know, I've got that excuse. I've realized how much I didn't like flying to begin with. I don't really know what the future holds for me. Trying to, take it one day at a time, get my work done, and have fun on Twitter. You know, that's the number one thing. Maybe I'll just be like, retired and tweeting all day. Because that's something I do enjoy doing. The amount of opportunity from kind of what this technology unlocks is pretty astounding. I like the idea of rebuilding the financial system. And I think that this is something the Ethereum folks are really focused on. I question the engineering and the economics of what specifically they're building today, but I applaud their spirit and the enthusiasm they have for, okay, now that we've got a monetary layer, let's think about what does financial intermediation look like on top of it.
Yeah, that's a great response. I think I'm certainly a fan of taking things one day at a time myself, and focusing more on like process and habits versus like goals. And there's certainly a lot between, your garden and Mars. So I'm sure there's a lot of things that could become interesting and attract you to work on them and do things, you know, other than maybe what you're doing now in the future. But I'm glad you're enjoying what you're doing, and congratulations on becoming a father. Thank you so much generally for coming on and sharing your perspective. In closing, where can people go and find, you know, well, first of all, they need to go check out your Twitter. So if you could share where the handle is, and I know there's a bunch of impersonators weirdly, so let's make sure we get the right one. And then secondarily, anything else you want to point people towards would be great.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. So you can find me on Twitter at Pierre, P-I-E-R-R-E underscore Rochard, R-O-C-H-A-R-D. And go to the Nakamoto Institute. If you just search, Google search Nakamoto Institute. My DMs are open on Twitter. So if you have questions or comments, happy to chat about Bitcoin. Favorite topic. Thanks again for having me on, Jake.